It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and the focus of our program today is labor unions, the part they have played in the economic development of this region and their continuing role now and into the future. I'm joined now in Studio A by Steve Herzenberg, Executive Director of the Keystone Research Center. Steve Herzenberg, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Great to be here, Paul.
Also with us by phone from Harrisburg is Matt Briette, President and CEO of the Commonwealth Foundation for Public Policy Alternatives. Matt Briette, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Paul. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Matt.
And if you would like to join the conversation, you can call 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Our email address is ESSPGH@WESA.FM. And you can reach us on Twitter at ESSPGH and follow the conversation at #EPLive. Once again, our number, 412-246-2002. Gentlemen, today only 11% of the nation's workers are unionized compared to a peak of 35% during the 1950s. Former U.S. Labor Secretary Robert Reich says with the decline of unions has come the stagnation of American wages, and when unions are strong, the economy is strong. Should we accept what he is saying? Steve Herzenberg, let's start with you.
I think former Labor Secretary Reich is on target. Again, when you look, for example, at the recovery from the recent Great Recession, not only have we had job growth that's been too slow, but we've also had wages that have basically been flat and actually slightly declining even in the recovery. That's got a lot to do with why the private economy is rebounding more slowly than we would like. You know, a strong middle class is absolutely what created three or four decades of 3% growth on average every single year from the 30s to the 70s. So a strong middle class is still a powerful engine for a healthy economy, and the decline of unions is part of the problem that our current economy has.
Matt Briette, are strong unions inextricably linked with a strong economy as far as you're concerned?
No, I don't think that there is a direct correlation, and certainly we don't see that when you drill down to the experiments, the 50-state experiment we have here in America. There certainly isn't a link to having strong unions and economic growth, whether it's personal income growth or all the other measurements that demonstrate that we are improving. So I don't think that there is a correlation between the two. And ultimately, we find that you will have greater economic prosperity when you give workers more freedom, not less.
Steve, you're shaking your head no.
No, I mean, there's a report. A lot of conservative think tanks, self-labeled free market think tanks, talk all the time about their policy recipe as if that translated into better economic performance. It's just nonsense. There's a great report not long ago by the Iowa Policy Project called Selling Snake Oil to the States, and it walks through the actual facts of the case, whether you're talking about job growth or income growth. There's either no relationship between right to work and all of the other conservative prescriptions and better outcomes, or the correlation goes in the wrong direction. So those are the facts.
Yeah, and we've seen the idea proposed of states being right to work states, so called right to work states. Matt Briette, would you explain exactly what that means? What does right to work mean?
Yeah, that's a good question, because ultimately what this says is that people have the freedom to join or not to join a union, and I fully support, and I think that this is important at the outset, I fully support the ability of employees to collectively bargain, to join a freedom of association, to say, hey, we want to work together and negotiate with our employer for those work rules and wages. I fully support that, and we do so at the Commonwealth Foundation. But what we don't support is allowing a private organization to have exclusive representation and then the ability to force an employee to pay that private organization dues or fees as a condition of employment. And these are the policy changes that we support changing, not to get rid of unions, not to decimate the ability of people to collectively bargain, but to say, hey, an individual should not be forced to join any organization, any private organization that they don't want to be part of. And that's ultimately what Right to Work does, is it gives employees the ability to join or not to join a union as a condition of employment, and they have the ability to collectively bargain if they so choose in right-to-work states. And this is ultimately just giving individual workers the freedom to choose.
412-246-2002, if you would like to join the conversation. Steve, what about Matt's point? What about the idea that employees should not be, in his view and the view of others, strong-armed into having to join a union if in fact, they, for whatever reason, do not want to?
Again, workers actually aren't forced to join unions. Workers collectively make the choice about whether to have a union in a certain place. Workers always have the right as a group to decertify a union if they want to get rid of it. It's very easy to get lost in the technical details of some of Right to Work, which, again, the research suggests is appropriately called Right to Work for Less, because workers generally, including non-union workers, earn less in states with Right to Work laws. But let's be unambiguously clear about what Right to Work is. Right to Work is a deliberate effort to weaken workers' voice on the job, in the economy, and in politics. So when you look at the American economy today, the Pennsylvania and Pittsburgh economies today, I think the idea that we need workers to be weaker in the economy, more of our wealth going to the top 1%, I think the idea that we need our politics to be more responsive to the 1%, the people who would benefit from weakening workers further, reducing workers' wages further, is misguided. We are in deep trouble because of the growth of inequality, because our democratic system is much too responsive to individual deep pocket, often unfortunately right-wing donors. And so Right to Work is really part of a misguided set of policy prescriptions which will undermine opportunity in the American dream and are corroding American democracy.
Pittsburgh has traditionally been a strong union town. When the national economy tanked 5 years ago, Pittsburgh and Allegheny County were in better shape than much of the rest of the nation. Is there a correlation there?
I would say probably not. Matt and I might actually be able to agree on this. The biggest thing, Pittsburgh didn't enjoy as big a housing boom and also has a pretty diversified economy. So I think there are mostly other characteristics of the Pittsburgh economy that help account for the less deep recession and the slightly more robust recovery.
Let's go to a caller at 412-246-2002. We have John in Morningside on the line. John, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. You're on with Matt Briette and Steve Herzenberg.
Matt and Steve, I want to add on something to the right to work issue here. Is this still a big force in our country? I know the last state I think that fell to that was Indiana. Is it a big matter in Harrisburg for our own state to have this installed once and for all? And secondly,
Let's take the first part of your question, then I'll let you ask part two. But there is a
There is a bill.
There is a bill.
Representative Daryl Metcalf, I believe, is the chief sponsor of a Pennsylvania Right to Work bill. I believe Right to Work passed in Michigan. Matt, I'm sure, could correct me.
Certainly, that was December of 2012. That was the 24th recent state to
okay
become Right to Work.
Thank you. So
Indiana was just before that.
So there hasn't been a lot of states that moved in that direction, but there's absolutely a strong movement supported by Matt and others that want more states to be Right to Work. They're not hiding anything about that. What I would say is, again, when you look at the data, Right to Work is not good for states. It's particularly bad for upward mobility. There was a recent phenomenal study of upward mobility put out by Harvard and Berkeley economists in July. And if you look at a map of the states and part in the U.S. with the lowest upward mobility, so the lowest chance that if you're born into the bottom fifth of the income spectrum, the lowest chance that you'll have to make it into the top fifth, there's basically – the map is identical. The states with the lowest upward mobility – the weakest American dream are the states with Right to Work laws.
John, Paul, if I could weigh in on this. Yeah, what we've seen here in Pennsylvania is that over the last 30 years, we've seen the loss of over 460,000 union members while we added more than a million employees in our state. So you see a strong reversal. And what Steve is suggesting is that all of these people are surrendering the opportunity to make more, to earn more, to have greater protections in the workplace, because they could unionize here in Pennsylvania. But what we find is that people are saying, yeah, the unions did some wonderful things early on in their history, and they've helped to codify a lot of protections in our state and federal laws. But people are saying, we don't need them today, and they are not our key to prosperity. In fact, a lot of people are saying that unions actually hold good people back because they force the salary scales that make you pay one teacher the same as another simply based upon how many years they've been in the classroom. That's not the meritocracy that made America great, and that's why I believe, not because people, workers are stupid, that they don't want to earn more, these hundreds of thousands of people, but it's because they recognize, hey, we can earn this on our own merit. We don't have to have this constant struggle between labor
well,
and
let me,
management.
Let me jump in. Employers
are treating us well.
Well, let me ask you this. And we've heard those kinds of criticisms about what unions allegedly do to strong-arm employees. At the same time, are we to believe now in the 21st century that things are different than they were in the 19th and 20th centuries, and that businesses are benevolent, and that we can trust those in management to treat workers fairly without representation, that the unions can just go away and everything will be fine?
This is why I support the right to collectively bargain, and that employees that want to engage in that practice should be absolutely protected by law to do so. So my point, again, this is an important point, is it's not about whether or not unions should be allowed to form and engage in those practices. It's whether or not we should allow private organizations, because that's what unions are, to have one exclusive representation, meaning that no other union can represent employees in a workplace, or that private organization can force someone to pay them in order to keep their job.
Steve, and quick point. So let Steve jump in and make a quick point before we – and then let's get back to John because he has another question.
I'll just say very quickly again, the reason that the number of workers in unions has gone down is not because workers are making choices. It's because it's extremely difficult under the law in the U.S. for workers to form unions, much more difficult than most other advanced countries. And the second thing I would say is, again, unions are as important in the new economy as they were in the old. It's the only way we're getting back to a strong middle class, a revitalized American dream. And when you want to if you want evidence of workers really wanting unions, Charles already gave it to us. You're talking about hotel and restaurant workers, casino workers. You're talking about healthcare workers at UPMC. You're talking about janitorial workers in this region. There is ample evidence that lots of folks stuck in the low-wage service sector have said, enough. We want to reconstruct our economy so that we can have opportunity for ourselves and our children.
John, what about the second part of your question?
Oh, thank you. Matt, from the Commonwealth Fund, I just want to ask you, do you think it's right, though, let's say a person doesn't want to join that union, but yet they're going to enjoy all the benefits that go across with that, and pay without having to pay dues? Does that seem right to all the others they'll be working side by side with?
Absolutely not, and that's where I do not believe that unions should have to represent or do anything on behalf of anybody who does not voluntarily support them and pay those dues and fees. So I do not believe that unions should be forced to represent anybody who is not joining them. And so this is where
how do you separate that, though, Matt?
Well, we have many workforces that have unionized workers and non-unionized. So this isn't something unique to be able to have employees that some are unionized and others are not. So to suggest that the unions have to represent other people is an area where I would agree with the unions. They should not be forced to do so any more than an employee should be forced to join the union as a condition of employment.
Steve, is that not a unique situation?
Sure it is. I mean, again, plenty of workplaces have managers that aren't in unions and then some hourly workers that are in unions. But, workplaces, if you're particular groups of workers, particular occupations of workers are either in the union or they're not in the union. Matt's suggestion is not a real suggestion. It's a completely impractical suggestion. He doesn't mind because, again, his point is to make an ideological argument that weakens workers' rights. The practical effect of the kinds of policies he supports, again, is more inequality and also a weaker worker voice in politics.
Well, John, thank you for that phone call. Let's go to Albert in Oakland who wanted to make a comment. Albert, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
I want to comment first about the remarks made by the gentleman in Harrisburg.
Matt Briette.
It's been established for a long time that employees working in the private sector don't need to become members of a union. The courts have clearly established that. The issue raised by the Beck cases deal with what kind of financial support must someone pay a union who is required to exclusively represent them. And the issue of exclusive representation, you know, certainly was established by the National Labor Relations Board back in the 30s, because that's the only way that a union can become strong enough to really bargain effectively with an employer. If you had six or seven different unions representing 100 employees at the plant, the employer would pick the weakest one and you know, sit down and bargain with them. So that's a totally impractical resolution. The other thing is you've commented about the 11%. It's really something like 8 or 9% in the private sector and maybe 40% in the public sector. And I think that has something to do with the ineffectiveness of the National Labor Relations Act, frankly.
And your point is well taken. I'm not sure about the figures, but let's let Matt Briette respond to what you're saying here, Albert, and then we need to get to final comments. Go ahead,
Matt.
Yeah,
actually, it is it is over 50% that's in the public sector, and that is where organized labor has focused most of its energies because the private sector has been on the decline, even in areas where it used to be a labor stronghold in the building trades. And so that is where you see the growth is in the public sector. And that is, you know, this is something where we agree with FDR and even the AFL-CIO until the 1950s that said, government is a monopoly, and if you give a monopoly over the workforce in a government monopoly, that is a threat to the public safety and the public purse. And that has only changed recently that we've allowed public employees to have that power to strike against the taxpayers, whether it's kicking kids out of school. And these are the things that, unfortunately, that organized labor has, I think, in many ways shot itself in the foot, that it has not been able to do the kinds of organizing of employees that it would like to see simply because of these types of actions that have turned off a lot of workers. And that's the unfortunate thing that, where I support the ability to collectively bargain, I'm the first one to say that there are bad actors out there running companies and that employees should have that ability to push back.
Okay, let me jump in.
It's about individual freedom at the end of the day. That's why I support the ability for people to organize or not to organize.
Steve Hertzenberg, we'll let you have the quick final word here.
Sure. Well, again, our basic view is that stronger unions are the only way to get back in America, Pennsylvania, Pittsburgh, which has a strong middle class, which has opportunity for all, which has a strong democracy that's responsive to typical families. I think the good news is that while for 30 years many people thought unions weren't as important in today's economy as in the past, people are now realizing that we can't fix inequality, that we can't make our politics more responsive to regular folk unless we have stronger unions. And you see at UPMC healthcare workers, at the adjunct faculty that Charles talked about, the hotel and restaurant workers, you see basically in the low-wage service jobs that are that aren't mobile, that can't go to Tijuana or to China. You see workers sort of figuring out that if we come together in our labor market, we can lift up our wages and benefits to the middle class. We can demand decent treatment. We can deliver better quality and service and productivity to our customers. It's going to be a win-win. And the exciting thing is that in Pittsburgh, at UPMC, and in these other contexts, people are figuring out what an economy that works for all would look like. So whoever you are in the listening audience, support those efforts. Please recognize that it's in the best interest not only of those particular workers, but of the region as a whole. Let's have Pittsburgh once again show America a path forward to a brighter future.
Steve Herzenberg is executive director of the Keystone Research Center. Steve Herzenberg, thank you for joining us. And with us by phone from Harrisburg, Matt Briette, president and CEO of the Commonwealth Foundation for Public Policy Alternatives. Matt Briette, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Coming up, a conversation with Philip Dine, author of State of the Unions, It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.